You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of March 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Under the Vienna Convention, the United Kingdom will now expel 23 Russian diplomats who have been identified as undeclared intelligence officers. They have just 1 week to leave.
The saga of the poisoned spy rumbles on with threats, counter-threats, measures, countermeasures and plain old-fashioned name-calling. My guests James Rogers and Samira Shackle will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including a wretched anniversary for Syria as its civil war officially enters year 8, China's peculiar pettiness towards Pakistanis, and the UN reveals the world's happiest country. Put the champagne on ice, Russia. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are James Rogers, Head of International Journalism Studies at City University London, and Samira Shackle, freelance journalist, contributor to New Statesman, Guardian, Al Jazeera, Deutsche Welle and Monocle, among others. Welcome both. And we will start in the UK, where Prime Minister Theresa May has been visiting Salisbury, scene of the apparent attempted poisoning murder of former Russian intelligence officer Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia 11 days ago. As the Prime Minister reiterated her condemnation of Russia for its alleged involvement in the attack, Russia described the very suggestion that it would act in such a manner as absolutely boorish and insane. UK Defence Minister Gavin Williamson, and in fairness he is new to this, said that Russia should go away and shut up. James, how do we reckon this is going?
Not terribly well. I mean, I think Gavin Williamson's remarks, to which you just referred, are undiplomatic. They suggest a lack of control. And probably, the diplomatic expulsions aside, a lack of clear policy. But the UK's options are actually quite limited. Reports coming out of Moscow also, I think, suggested that they were expecting a rather more robust response, and perhaps the government's keeping that in reserve. But I don't think that the UK does really have many options, and the diplomatic expulsions are a fairly obvious one in that sense. The scale, nevertheless, is extremely large. 23 out of a Russian diplomatic corps based in the UK, so quite significant, and we await now what Russia's response to that's going to be.
Well, Samira, Russia has said that there will be a response. Rather amusingly, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is taking the high horse on this, saying that, you know, he will inform Britain first because that, as he put it, is what gentlemen do. But if Russia is involved in the original poisoning attempt, and just for the benefit of the doubt, for the fun of it rather, let's give them the benefit of the doubt, but if they are involved, they will have factored in the idea that there would have been a response. They will have assumed that Britain would react by throwing out a certain number of diplomats. That's the cost of doing business. They would have seen this coming, wouldn't they?
Possibly, although actually, I mean, there's been quite a few kind of murders or suspicious suicides with quite kind of potential links to Russia. I think there was
including one since the Salisbury poisoning.
Yes,
in fact,
exactly. And there, you know, I think there was that big BuzzFeed investigation that came out in the summer that identified 14 where there'd been either kind of Home Office intervention to stop police investigations and so on. So I think there definitely has been a kind of precedent set where we've got, probably, it looks like, again, you can't say definitely, but probably double figures of these types of operations, perhaps not using nerve agents, but still kind of Russia taking action against perceived traitors or whatever it is on British soil. So all the abuse of sovereignty and all the rest of it and all the things that everyone's getting very angry about this week. So we have seen that quite consistently over the last decade. You know, we hear about the polonium attack a decade ago or whatever, but it's been going on quite consistently since then and just been kind of below the radar. So I think there probably has been a sense in Russia and Moscow, which I think would be quite justified, the feeling that they can probably push their luck and afford to, because there's not going to be a huge amount of fallout from it. And, you know, you even see with the... I'm having a complete mental blank for what his name was. What was the guy, the polonium poisoning?
Litvinenko.
Litvinenko, that was it. So he, with the kind of Litvinenko investigation and the inquest, you kind of could kind of track British-Russian relationships in the process of the Litvinenko inquiry. You know, it sort of goes a bit quiet, then an inquest comes out, then relations go bad a bit. But, you know, that still hasn't really, even from that, which was a very kind of massive sort of media story, even from that, there hasn't been necessarily a huge lasting fallout to the relationship. So I do think, as James says, the options are limited. And I also think that given the lack of action on the multiple incidents on British soil, that the Kremlin would have been quite justified thinking there might not be that much fallout.
James, it is of a piece, as Samira points out, with Russian behaviour, not merely in Britain, but in general in recent years. We see Russia do things which I think the majority of international opinion regards as outrageous, whereby it's invading Ukraine or invading Georgia or annexing Crimea, all the while saying it wasn't really us who did it, and even if it was, what are you going to do? You did say that the UK's options in this particular instance are limited, but are there further measures that could or should be contemplated?
Well, there are further measures which could or should be contemplated, and they're largely to do with financial aspects of the relationship. I mean, at the time that Alexander Litvinenko was murdered, I was a correspondent in Moscow, and I remember very clearly being struck by the fact that at the time that diplomatic expulsions were going on, British change stalls were building branches right across Russia. In other words, the trade was continuing and the economic relationship was still very, very healthy. I note this morning the Financial Times here is reporting that Gazprom, the Russian energy giant, raised €750 million worth of bonds in London yesterday, the same day the Prime Minister was making this speech. So that continues. There is a possibility of cutting back on that. There is a possibility of preventing wealthy Russians from buying properties in the expensive parts of London, from sending their kids to the most expensive schools in the UK, but that of course would have consequences for those parts of the UK luxury economy that are doing rather well out of that at the moment too.
Samira, is there a case, or are we getting to the point where there might be a case for possibly more cosmetic measures, but nonetheless ones that would register, such as, for example, yanking RT's broadcasting licence, that's the Kremlin-sponsored propaganda channel, and declining to turn up for the World Cup?
Potentially. I mean, as you say, those are still symbolic actions, but I guess they would be a kind of step up from what we've seen now. I think ultimately, if there's going to be any kind of concrete change, as James said, it would have to be those kinds of concrete measures, financial policies and so on. Because we've seen, you know, that diplomatic expulsions don't really do a whole amount. And I don't know if, you know, British figures not turning up to the World Cup is really going to make that much difference. If you think that the kind of ultimate crime that the Kremlin and Putin and whatever want to be punishing is this crime of betrayal and defection and so on, and those are most of the people who have been assassinated or it's suspected that they've been assassinated on British soil are people who have defected from the regime in some way or betrayed the regime in some way. And I think that seems to be the priority rather than whether British dignitaries come to watch a football match.
There has been some muttering, James, of the invocation of Article 5 of the NATO Treaty, which I think most people think would be a bit of an overreaction, given that the only other time that has been invoked was after the September 11th attacks on the United States. But might there be an argument for things, I guess, halfway between that and what we've just been talking about? Just thinking out loud, if every NATO country said we're not coming to the World Cup.
I think that's probably pretty unlikely, though, isn't
not
it?
Not saying I think it's likely, yeah, but I mean, would that have a corrective
possibly
effect on Russia's behaviour?
Possibly. I mean, I think if you look at recent Russian history, there has been, you know, the big sporting events, the Winter Olympics in Sochi, and then the first time they staged the Football Champions League final in 2008, that's felt like a dress rehearsal for that. It's very, very, very much a part of Russia's reinstating itself, claiming what it sees as its natural place on the world stage. So these big sporting events are very important. As I'm sure you'll know, Andrew, there's been a joke going around London for some years now that England would protest either by not qualifying or by being knocked out of the group stage, and of course that still remains a distinct possibility.
Well, let's take a look now at Syria. 7 years ago today, give or take, as the Middle East was convulsed by what turned out to be optimistically known as the Arab Spring, Facebook activists in Syria called for a day of rage. 7 years later, the country remains a battlefield, hosting not merely an infernally complex civil war, but a counterinsurgency campaign against the remnants remnants of a terrorist statelet and a proxy conflict involving Turkey, Russia, the United States and Saudi Arabia, among very many others. Samira, the useless but intriguing question first. If we, by which I guess I mean the West, knew then what we know now, what might have been done differently?
I think perhaps there would have been more military intervention at an earlier stage. We talk a lot about inaction in Syria. There has been kind of quite large-scale foreign intervention in Syria. It just hasn't really been very useful. You know, you've got Iranian and Russian massive support of the regime, and you have kind of Western allies led by the US intervening very specifically to
and
target
Turkey
ISIS.
Fighting on both
and Turkey,
sides.
Of course, yeah, of course. So to kind of put aside for a minute the fallacy that there isn't kind of foreign intervention in Syria, I think perhaps if we had known now what we know, then there might have been intervention of a different type. I don't know. I mean, as always, there's often unexpected results from that, and they might not have led to a kind of peace. It very often doesn't. But I think perhaps at the point when chemical weapons were used and it was a red line, perhaps there would have been more substantive action then, and perhaps we might have seen Western action targeted at the regime, not solely at ISIS, which is then kind of the bigger threat. And the vast majority of atrocities in Syria, of course, are committed by the regime, and there doesn't seem to be much. There's a huge sort of discomfort about talking about that amongst Western power brokers.
And James, is it arguable, given what Samira just said, that the people of Syria, who are, of course, the real victims of this, are victims at one remove of the Iraq war? Was the West so spooked by the shambles they set themselves up to walk into there that there was no meaningful political possibility of any intervention in Syria?
I think that's a very good point. I mean, I think there was a lot of discussion at the time, and you remember when the decision was taken relatively early in the conflict about whether Britain was going to conduct airstrikes, and there's a vote in Parliament. One very, very, very strongly sensed that the ghosts of unsuccessful operations in Iraq and Afghanistan were present there at that point. And I think Samira makes a very good point that there probably was a time, probably, you know, 5, 6, even 6.5 years ago, where all those parties who are now involved, had they exerted their influence as it was then, Russia perhaps on President Assad's administration, the United States and its allies on those members of the opposition where they may have had influence, they might actually have got involved and been able to bring an end to this. But of course, that is way, way, way back in the past. And I think all we can do now, looking back 7 years later, is look at it with some regret and wonder where the future is going to lead. Interesting role for Russia. We've just been talking about Russia. Their involvement has been decisive, highly influential, but their end game isn't clear either. And I think if we think about the age of the people in power in Moscow now, they're all old enough. Many of them did serve in Afghanistan, which turned out to be a truly disastrous war. And they will probably be looking for a clear strategy, which is going to enable them to leave there.
The somewhat terrifying precedent, of course, where Syria is concerned, and I'm far from the first person to invoke it, is the civil war in neighbouring Lebanon, which, lest we forget, lasted for 18 years, 75 to 93, and actually involved fewer players than this one. Weird thought that we may not even be at the halfway point. But Samira, the anniversary has prompted a certain amount of beard scratching and hand wringing, not all of it screechingly sanctimonious, among the media that have bothered to cover the Syrian civil war, about why nobody really seems all that interested. Was there a particular point at which attention to this conflict among the mainstream of Western populations just switched off?
I think it's probably about how long it's gone on for. And I think I would argue that actually generally with most conflicts, particularly long-running ones, you have moments where there's perhaps a kind of surge of news coverage and public sympathy, often prompted by a single incident. You know, they're the very tragic toddler who was found, I think it was in Italy, the Alan Kurdi, the little kid, kind of highlighted the refugee situation, and by proxy of the Syrian war, a huge outpouring of empathy, and then it just kind of moves on. And I think similarly, you know, with the kind of conflict happening there, you have these moments where something really shocking happens. We had that when with the siege of Aleppo, and then that's sort of everywhere, and then it just goes. I think you just do, public has fatigue. It's far away, it's hard to understand, and it's gone on for 7 years. So I don't think it's really that surprising that, you know, as a journalist who actually covers foreign affairs a lot, it's always an uphill battle to get the public interested in kind of faraway stories. So something that's so long running and so complex, I think.
Because James, I don't think that kind of indifference is anything new. I think if we go back 20 years while the war in the former Yugoslavia was occurring, I don't think really that many people cared all that much. And it is that thing Samira mentions. It's a big story. It goes on for ages. It's incredibly complicated, and which is why I think people do respond to that one relatable incident or person caught up in it that for some reason they feel like they can identify with.
Yeah, I think that's all absolutely right. But I would also add as well that I think the part combined with that fatigue that audiences, that readers get, they also have a sense of powerlessness. I mean, if there were something that could obviously be done, if a military intervention were simply to were able to end this, perhaps in the way that, you know, the eventual United States involvement in Yugoslavia helped to bring that to the end, then I think people would be in favour of that and would take a greater interest. But I think part of audiences' fatigue is brought about by a degree of despair and a sense of powerlessness, and it's not really clear what can be done. I mean, it is true, though, of course, you know, we're talking about the example of Aylan Kurdi, that the, you know, there are consequences felt right across the rest of the Middle East and into Europe because of the unprecedented numbers of people who have been on the move as a result of this conflict.
Well, you could make the argument that without the exflows from Syria, there's no Brexit and there's no Trump.
You certainly could make that argument, and it may well be something that historians will conclude in the future, indeed.
I mean, Samir, is it weird that the fact that we can now become, if we choose, so intimately acquainted with a conflict or a story like Syria that still we generally choose not to? Because this was the optimism that a lot of people had about the internet in its early stages, that it would make it impossible to look away from it. Because that's a big difference between Syria and Bosnia. 20 years ago, Bosnia is maybe on the 10 o'clock news for 3 minutes every night, or it's in the newspaper if you're the kind of person who reads a newspaper. But you could probably pretty much go about your daily life without knowing it was happening. You can't really do that with Syria, and yet people still don't seem all that interested.
Yeah, I think there's two things there. The first thing is that the kind of availability of the types of communication technology that we have now do allow a different kind of information flow, I guess would be the word. You know, so in a kind of besiegement situation like in Aleppo, where journalists absolutely can't go in, you have people being able to send photos and voice messages and all of that kind of thing, which might not have been available before, and it's very, very affecting some of that. But on the other hand, you have the much broader issue, which is about how we consume information, which is that when we didn't have the internet, you watched the 10 o'clock news and you saw what was on it, and you picked up a paper and you leafed through and you at least saw the headlines for stories that you weren't interested in. Now you can just go to the stories that you want to read. You just see stuff that people link to on Facebook. It's the whole thing about filter bubbles we heard so much about during Brexit and Trump. And so, you know, actually, I, as a kind of journalist primarily focusing on foreign affairs, feel that there's a huge amount of really great coverage out there, and it's kind of multifaceted and it's complicated and you can find so much of it. And I speak to people who'll say, oh, you know, this big thing's happening and there's no news about it. And actually it's that people aren't reading the news about it. It's kind of ongoing thing I have that. But
you see that a lot, that people say, why isn't the BBC covering this? And you send them the link.
Yeah, why isn't anyone talking about X thing that happened? Because, you know, people use it to make a kind of woke talking point. But actually there is a huge amount of coverage there, but it's just very, very easy to avoid it if you're not going to the world news pages.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with James Rogers and Samira Shackle. Coming up next, China's other quarrelsome border.
Monocle's stately March instalment comes with a decided South Korean flavour. We sit down with President Moon Jae-in to talk Trump, troublesome neighbours, and taking the time to watch TV with his cat, no less. Plus, we dedicate a 48-page survey to an in-depth look at South Korea through the chefs, artists, entrepreneurs, and designers shaping it. Elsewhere, we profile the key players searching for positive solutions in Jerusalem, meet the sharp minds making a point in the pencil industry, and augur the year ahead in art from New York, London, and Hong Kong. In the design pages, we mark the rise of timber towers from France to the US and bed down in the bedazzling dorms of a Copenhagen college that has us mulling over the merits of heading back to school. All before a breeze around the world's biggest outerwear fair, ISPO in Munich. And we chew over Paris's freshest new food shop. Monocle's March issue is out now and available on all good newsstands or by subscription.
You are back with Midori House, with me, Andrew Millister. With me are James Rogers and Samira Shackle. Now, we are accustomed to news of complex tensions along China's border with India. By way of change of pace, this week brings news of complex tensions along China's border with Pakistan. Pakistani traders who cross between the two countries are increasingly complaining of being separated from the wives they have met among the Uyghur Muslims on the other side of the frontier. There is even talk of these women being dispatched to, quote, re-education, unquote, camps. Samira, China's official line is that its bond with Pakistan is, and I quote, deeper than the deepest ocean, sweeter than honey, which is laying it on a little thick, frankly. Yeah. But what is going on here?
Yeah, it's really interesting you say that. So I spent quite a bit of time last year reporting on CPEC, which is the kind of not very catchy acronym for the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which is this kind of mad initiative that is planned to link the Uyghur region on the China-Pakistan border to a port in southern Pakistan, which then links out to the Persian Gulf and so on. So it's kind of trade route. And it's hugely expensive. It goes through lots of really dangerous bits of Pakistan. And the whole point was partly to kind of, for both China and Pakistan, was to kind of neutralise what they see as quite problematic regions. So the Uyghur region in China and Balochistan, which is where the port is. And that they're really, really shouting about that. As you say, the deeper than the deepest ocean, etc. I actually saw an ad for it randomly on a London bus, which didn't, I don't know why they were advertising a kind of trade route that China's building in Pakistan in London on a bus. It's very odd.
Unless that trade route's really going places.
Yeah, it's really strange. It just sort of ad for the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. It's bizarre. Didn't even have a website on it or anything. So there's that. And so it's quite an interesting contradiction that you get down to the ground level where there is this border where people are crossing back and forth all the time. They're intermarrying, they're trading, all of those things. And people are having this kind of fallout. And I think it all feeds into the Chinese government's anxiety about their Muslim population, and it's part of a whole host of repressive measures.
I mean, that concern, if you let's be charitable about it, that Beijing has about Xinjiang and the Uyghurs who live there is well documented. But why would they be bothered by the women of the region marrying men from across the border?
I think from the sounds of things, it's kind of feeds into a wider set of repressive policies affecting that population, and these women have been caught up in that. I think there's also anxiety about them. Apparently anyone from the Uyghur community who's travelling overseas to a list, they've got a list of 26 countries, is sometimes facing travel restrictions and being detained and so on. And I think these women are kind of falling into that. And I think perhaps there's also a worry about foreign influence I'm inferring there, but through intermarriage with Pakistanis, if Pakistan's on this kind of watch list of countries. And I think also probably it's my understanding is that this is a sort of regional set of policies. So maybe doesn't the sort of local politicians are maybe not considering the contradiction with the sweetest honey or whatever it is.
Hey, James, do we imagine the government in Islamabad is going to be terrifically concerned about this, or are they going to be more concerned by the north of $50 billion that China is spending in Pakistan to build CPEC?
Oh, one would imagine the latter, I think. I mean,
it was
an interesting story, this. I mean, obviously the trade links are extremely important, and I think the personal links probably come second best to that, particularly, where in the case of China, this is an example of the state feeling that it has every right to meddle in the most intimate parts of individuals' lives in this sense.
And which even China obviously has considerable form for.
Exactly, even down to saying, that it's not right to marry a foreigner. If you do, you might need to go to school to learn about whether that's a good idea or not.
Samira, just a final thought on this one. Is it imaginable that this becomes a thing in Pakistan if Pakistani religious leaders in particular get hold of it?
Potentially, but it's interesting. So the province that in Pakistan that borders China, Gilgit-Baltistan, is actually quite marginalised anyway. So that province doesn't really have kind of full constitutional rights. So it's not probably unlikely that it's something the federal government would bring up, also because of the trade issue that you mentioned. So they're also already kind of seen as a bit different. But I think if religious leaders of the religious lobby bring it up, then it does have that potential because they have a hugely loud voice in Pakistan.
Okay, well, finally tonight, a happy story, or at least a story about happiness. The UN's World Happiness Report has named the happiest country on Earth, and it is Finland, ahead of yet another clean sweep for the Nordic countries, with Norway, Denmark and Iceland filling out the minor placings. At the other end of the scale, last year's wooden spooners, the Central African Republic, have crawled up a notch, supplanted at the bottom of the index by Burundi. James, your initial response then to I've been to Finland. I have nothing against it. I would find the winters something of a chore, I confess.
Yeah, don't they have really high suicide rates?
I think that may be a bit of an urban myth, or that may be the Swedes. So I think only finished ninth, but not, well, I say only.
I've never been to Finland. I have lived for many years in Russia, so I know what extreme winters can be like.
And I don't think cracked the top 20.
No, but I have spent a lot of time in Scandinavia, and I do still spend quite a lot of time in Denmark. I spent a bit of time in Sweden visiting, and I do remember one story from Sweden actually, where I was a journalist and I'd been covering a summit there. I was on my way to the airport and I got a taxi driver who I didn't speak any Swedish. He spoke a bit of English. It turned out he was a refugee from the wars in Yugoslavia, and he offered the opinion that I guess this gentleman would have been about 40 odd, and he said, "Yeah, it's great. It's, you know, I'm here with my family." He said, "I think if I was younger, I'd find it a bit boring though." So I mean, obviously he knew of what he spoke. You know, the poor chap had fled war, and it's not a decision anyone takes lightly. But I think he liked the stability as a middle-aged family man. But I think if he'd been looking for a bit more adventure in life, one of these happy countries probably wasn't the place for him.
You have, of course, just there committed the great journalistic crime of quoting the taxi driver.
I just realised as I was saying it. Yeah, it's a long time ago. There must be a statute of limitations on that. Hopefully, it was at least 15 years ago.
Samira, have any countries you visited struck you as conspicuously cheerful? It's a weird thing to ascribe a mood to a country.
Well, what's quite funny, actually, so we've just been talking about Pakistan, which doesn't rate that highly. Obviously, it's got quite well-documented problems, and it's, I think, number 75 on this index. But people will sing and dance in the streets at the slightest opportunity. I just remember...
just outside my hotel window, if memory serves.
Exactly. I just remember watching... there was a cricket match, and it was an India-Pakistan cricket match, which they just give everyone the day off for to watch on telly. And so I was watching it. I have a very, very limited understanding of the rules of cricket, so I was watching it. But what I did notice was that everyone I was with in this cafe was sort of dancing on the tables, celebrating, cheering. So I assumed Pakistan was winning. So I asked my cousin who I was with, how's it going? He was like, oh, no, we're getting completely slaughtered. That was quite indicative of a cheerful mood.
James, I think we're writing Russia off, aren't we, among the world's most cheerful countries you visited. Has anyone you visited struck you as a conspicuously upbeat place?
Well, to be honest with you, I'm always quite surprised when the Nordic countries, as somebody spends quite a lot of time there, score so highly in this, because there's quite, you know, a good bit of grumbling, but I guess maybe they're sort of able to rationalise it when the surveyors come around. I mean, I've never been surveyed for one of these things. And I think, honestly,
finished 18th.
Would largely depend upon the mood. If I'd had a good day at work and the sun was shining my way home, I'd say, yeah, it's fantastic. I love living in London. It's great.
I think that's why they try to ask a lot of people.
Hopefully, their methodology is a little sounder than what I've just described, catching people on their way home from work. But you know, you can see that there's a low crime rate there. The weather's not great in Denmark, I suppose, but you know, people have pretty much got what they need, and I guess that's often what will lead people to be happy in any part of the world.
I mean, there is a serious point here, Samira, is like, do we learn anything about what people actually want from the fact that the Nordic countries seem really happy? I mean, the weather aside, which they can't do much about, what is it they've got right?
I don't know. I mean, they've got they make lots of efforts on things like equality, don't they? They've got lots on sort of leaders on things like gender equality, lots of public services, I guess. So quite a strong kind of sense of social contract, I guess you could guess from that. But I'm assuming they're not just asking people, are you happy for this survey, though? Surely they must be looking at some sort of data points.
They are looking at data, but they are basically just asking a lot of people.
Doesn't sound that solid.
Are you happy?
Yeah, interesting. I just wonder how they do that in places like Yemen, which ranks on the list.
Not very high.
Yeah.
You'd be unastonished to learn.
I mean, in certain parts of the world, presumably a sense of patriotism kicks in. You know,
yeah,
you have to say, well, yeah, of course, best country in the world.
Yeah.
Of course it is. Why would I not want to live here?
Yeah.
On that patriotic note, that does bring us to the end of today's show. James Rogers and Samira Shackle, thanks for joining us. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Rabello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Amber Roberts. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. Music next, 1900 Andrew Tuck is in with The Urbanist. I'm back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns tomorrow at 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Mullett. Thank you for listening.